Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, regulating big tech. And Richard, we turn to this today. This topic has engendered a lot of discussion over the past year or so, whether and how the federal government should regulate the tech industry. And this conversation often comes from a somewhat poorly defined sense of unease about Silicon Valley and how much influence they have, both in the economy and in the broader society. So there's a number of different ways we could go with this. I want to start with the data side. I mean, one of the big controversies around this was a few months ago when it was revealed that Cambridge Analytica, the data firm that worked on the Trump campaign, had been scraping data from Facebook users, apparently in a way that was consistent with Facebook's rules at the time. And this led to Mark Zuckerberg being hauled before Congress. And it's also led to proposals like the one by Ro Khanna, who's a congressman who actually represents part of Silicon Valley, to have what he calls an Internet Bill of Rights, where you would know what data companies have about you. You'd have the right to limit their use of it, and you'd have the right to consent to its transfer. So, Richard, to what degree do you see a need for government to get in there and act as a buffer between users and tech companies on these data questions?
Well, I'm actually somewhat puzzled by the whole Cambridge Analytica situation. I mean, I take it what the charge was, that some of this information went into the hands of Trump people and were used to help them fabricate their advertisements and spiels. If it was something which was equally open to the Democrats to do, then in effect you don't see any kind of imbalance or competitive disadvantage going to one side or another. And so the first question I asked myself is, suppose it had turned out that Hillary Clinton had been able to scrape some data from the Zuckerberg's fight, would the same kind of outrage have taken place? And if the answer to that question is no, then it turns out that you've got yourself some kind of a partisan value or battle. And I'm very uneasy about trying to regulate Republicans when you don't do Democrats or vice versa. If the answer to that question is yes, then I do think that maybe you have a problem on your hand. But let's suppose you do have a problem on your hand. How big a problem is it? Well, all the data that they get essentially is data which is kind of aggregated in some form or another to be useful. And what do they do with it? They don't use this particular information to get into your bank book and to start pulling funds out of it. What they do is they try to figure out how it is they're going to launch their political campaign. There are ways to figure out other information sources about messaging. So why this one is worse than the others, which are perfectly legal, is somehow or other always a little bit uneasy. There is, even in the Fourth Amendment area, this kind of real unease about the government tracking your cell phone locations one way or another. There was a case called Carpenter, and Chief Justice Roberts said it's really terrible to do all of that. My reaction was exactly the opposite on that case. I want the government to be able to pinpoint where people are without opening up the messages if they have some suspicion that there's foul play at stake. It's cheaper to do it, and it's much more reliable. And the argument is that we want highly inefficient ways in which to track and organize criminals is, to me, something quite foolish. And so this is a modest invasion of privacy done on a probable cause basis. I think it's the right thing to do. One of the objects of a criminal law is to stop crime. And I have a similar reaction with respect to these advertisements. Years ago, American Express essentially used to take its data and give it out to companies so they could target advertisements based upon what people had bought to give you a sense as to whether or not they would buy it. But they didn't give this data away for free. What they did is they found a way to put lists together, and you would have a limited number of uses you could make of it, which you paid for, and then they would be able to track by salting the data set to see if you would abuse the privilege. So there's going to be all sorts of limits on this kind of thing. And I was just frankly a little bit overwhelmed about the sort of furious reaction associated with this. And I guess I want to put myself on the side of those who sort of likes privacy but understands that there are different measures of it. And roughly speaking, I'm much more concerned if somebody takes information from my sources about me than if somebody takes information from sort of quasi-public sources, what I bought, where I've been, and so forth, and then uses that information to try to persuade me or to try to sell me. But I think I'm on the wrong side of history in this particular case, and there'd be a lot of resonance on the other side. But let's be very clear about this. If you're Facebook, and you need to get the approval of everybody before any piece of information can be transferred to anybody else, your business model is forever broken. And what you're going to have to do is to make a lot of other changes that people may not want so much. You're going to have to start charging for services that are now rendered. Because if you can't get paid by using the information collected from Facebook users, and I don't use Facebook, if you can't use that information to organize ads and other kinds of buying, then in effect what happens is your revenue stream is gone and you have to get the information from some other way. So the right question to ask anybody who's into this thing is, how much are you prepared to pay to get the kind of privacy you want from the kinds of incursions that you're talking about in this case? And my guess is, apart from a lot of very determined activists, most people kind of prefer the zero-cost shared information model to the high-cost total privacy model. I'm willing to take information about this, but if Mr. Zuckerberg and his company found out that people really did care about this and were prepared to pay, then I would expect to see a new service, which I will now call Facebook Prime, which comes out there, and for people who want to keep their data free from everybody else, they can now pay a fee of $25 a month in order to use the system. I don't think that product is going to be lost. My own sense has always been that people are very, very reluctant to pay for anything on the internet with cash. They'd much rather pay for it with ads.
Richard Khanna has also called, as have some others, for more rigorous antitrust scrutiny of tech companies. And there was a lot of criticism about this during Zuckerberg's time on the Hill, about the fact that Facebook doesn't face robust enough competition. Under typical thinking about antitrust, how much of a problem do social media companies pose?
Well, this is a very difficult question in antitrust law, and it's one on which there are quite different responses under the sort of standard European Union view and the standard United States view. The most important case in the United States is a case called Grinnell, and it may have involved alarm companies or something. But essentially, the position that was taken in that case, and which has been cited time after time, is that it's perfectly okay to get a monopoly position so long as you grow internally from your own sources and your own revenues. So if you basically plant a little acorn and you manage to create an oak, but you're not engaged in mergers and you're not engaged in various kinds of collusive practices, a cartel arrangement with everybody else, it's yours to keep. And the argument in favor of all of that is that if you really want people to start to grow, it's not going to happen if you tell them once you grow, we're going to break you up. And to think back as to what happened to Microsoft back in 1998, when everybody had this anxiety attack about them, the company for many years stumbled after these antitrust suits were given. They were hobbled by all sorts of crazy decrees, including one which required it to give information to IBM and other people as to all of its future tech developments so they can decide whether or not there was some monopoly risk in the technique or the technology shifts. And that, of course, became the source of enormous abuse on the other side because you kept on demanding all the information you didn't need to run your business but to slow them down. And so I'm just not real happy about abandoning the American model. You go over to Europe, and they're all over this. The whole Google thing, to some extent, is a dominance claim worth $5 billion. And the basic theory was that what these guys did is they pre-programmed their own stuff so that what they did is they gave themselves an advantage by pre-installing Google Chrome on virtually all of its apparatuses. They didn't prevent anybody else from downloading. Most tech users are quite sophisticated, and downloading is not a heroic application. We have to file an heroic task. We have to file an application with a bank and wait 6 months before you get it. Most people routinely download apps. And this is worth $5 billion and more. And most of the American companies were basically squawking about, well, why is it that the Europeans are always doing this to us? And the most sober observation you make about this is, where are the European tech companies? Where is the European eBay? Where is the European Amazon? Where is the European Facebook? Where is the European Apple? Where is the European Google? And the answer, they don't have anybody like that. And they'll never get anybody like that. because if they apply their own antitrust laws to their own acorns, they will never get any oaks. It's much more complicated. There are other things that necessarily influence, but that's the antitrust battle. And on that one, I think I'm pretty much on the side of the American situation. The way in which you curb a monopoly power is you create somebody who has a new entry. And this has happened all the time. I gather there was a company called MySpace before there was Facebook, and we know what's happened to them. There was Netscape before there's Internet Explorer, and we know what happened to them. What happens is if you have a dominant position, there's a very low probability of a very high catastrophic loss. And that's enough to keep you awake at night. And most of the time, these innovators are looking for new products and ways to lower their prices because they know that if they can expand their base and increase the number of services that they provide, they will push back in time and in space all of the efforts of new people to try to come into this business. So the defensive strategies that are adopted by incumbent companies are to some extent a response to these pressures, and therefore you get much more pro-competitive behavior than you might have thought if you had assumed that none of these entry risks were facing companies that were as dominant as Facebook and Google and all the rest of it.
Richard, amongst conservatives, there is a real sense of anxiety about the tech companies sometimes because of a sense that they have this incredible market power and they use it to put a thumb on the scale for progressive causes. So let me get you to respond to your Hoover colleague, Jeremy Carl, who wrote the following in National Review about a year ago. Quote, "In my scholarly work, I write primarily about energy policy, in which electric utilities are usually referred to as natural monopolies. Government regulation of these utilities has traditionally been justified to avoid having multiple companies building redundant and costly infrastructure and distribution assets. For conservatives, the time has begun to think of some major web services, in particular Facebook, Google, YouTube, and Twitter, in the same way. Yes, they are private companies, just as many utilities are. And yes, these internet monopolies do not have the same physical infrastructure advantages that electric utility monopolies have. But because of their network effects, their dominance and monopoly power are in many ways starker." Close quote. Your reaction to that, Richard?
Well, I mean, this is basically another reversion to the debate you have between the American and the European authorities. When you're dealing with information type situations, it turns out there are enormous advantages in economies of scale from having a network. I mean, the definition of a network at this particular point is that any person who's involved in a particular kind of transportation or communication activity knows that it could reach any other person on that system. And the moment it turns out that you have two carriers, then you're going to have to figure out how it is that you integrate their services, and it slows down the operation of the network, which leads to the claim that there's some kind of a natural monopoly associated with this situation. And once you start to see that, it becomes much more aggravated in this particular case because there are two effects of the network monopoly that one worries about, and you have very different reactions to them. One of them is the price side. Well, this is just not really an issue in any of these cases. Most of the time, you get all of these Google services and Facebook services for free, paying for it, as I mentioned before, with the advertisements. So this is not like the railroads engaging in pricing, which essentially gouges short-haul people in order to keep the system going. And they did it for perfectly good reasons. If you try to basically raise the price on the long hauls where there's competition, you always lose out. On the short haul, you have a local monopoly. So it turned out that the price inversion, where you charge more money to the guy who has the shorter route, actually is an efficient economic solution, which turns out to be politically extremely controversial and very difficult to maintain. What he's really worried about is on the information side. And what he's saying there essentially is if you start looking at these companies, these are not old line steel companies with implicit Republican credentials. These guys are all liberal Democrats, MSNBC, Zuckerberg, Google guys, Mac guys. They're all very much on the left side of the political system. And I have no question that that's the case. And you start looking at some of the reasons why you believe that, and you think of the incredible problems with James Damore and the sort of the Google fight over whether or not women programmers are or not equal to men. And this guy gets fired from the company for offending our company values, which is a word for, say, some kind of intolerance. So people are saying, if you're willing to do that to somebody who's inside, well, you're going to do the same thing to somebody on the outside. And then what you do is you say, look, these guys are the only place that we can go. And after all, think of what the government did when it started through Lois Lerner and company to basically give a much more difficult time to any conservative organization speaking some kind of charitable exemptions from various IRS taxes or having a tax-exempt status. So this is a very real concern. My own view about it, however, is that if you try to get the government involved in this thing, it's probably worse than the disease. So I think that the correct equilibrium is a very unhappy and unstable one, is they continue to engage in their practices, and everybody who disagrees with them starts to scream at the top of their voice saying, look at what they're doing to X, Y, and Z when it comes to the kind of information in question. What then happens, of course, is from the other side, poor Facebook is being pummeled by people saying, well, you didn't take these guys off fast enough. And Zuckerberg stumbles badly, not because he said anything so outrageous. He's saying, well, you know, these Holocaust deniers, are these people with bona fide positions that I have to let on, or these people whom I have to take off, right? And there's huge pressure to take those people off of the system from just about everybody. So on the one hand, there are people saying, well, he's just cutting out our friends. And there are other people saying he's not cutting out these really vicious people on the other side. It's very difficult to know what to do if you're running the company and trying to maintain your good name. I'm not an expert on this, believe me. But if you're trying to now add another layer and you're talking about government, well, which government? Federal government, international government, every state government, every local government. What's going to be the content of these kinds of regulations? I see more proposals for more tech industries for regulation, which everybody says, here's a market imperfection. But what I never see is a well-drafted statute which actually tells you this is what we're going to do. Let me just take a little comparison. I've been doing a lot of reading lately about and writing about Uber and its so-called abuse of its various drivers. And everybody says, well, let's have a minimum wage law. New York Times, Bill de Blasio. Well, the people who drive for Uber also drive for Lyft. They also drive on their own account. They also do their homework in their cars. How do you figure out what the minimum wage law is going to be per hour when you have no idea of how many hours these people are working for this company or that company? It just doesn't work. And one has to be constantly aware about the following proposition, which Harold Demsitz many years ago called the Nirvana fallacy. He said, just because you can show a serious imperfection that market forces are not easily able to overcome, doesn't mean that you've made the case for government regulation. It's always a question of relative imperfections. Is the regulation going to create a bureaucracy of high cost and erratic behavior? Do we really want to make sure that the government, if it turns out to be a Trump administration, is going to oversee Facebook? And if it turns out we then have the Trump administration and a progressive Democrat comes in down the road, you're going to have these enormous flip-flops. You're going to have all sorts of discontinuities. It's not as though the history of information regulation is very good. And you have all the First Amendment issues that nobody, frankly, fully knows how to sort out. So I think the right answer to this is to say what he's identified, Carl has identified, is a very serious kind of issue. Anyone who wants to belittle it is wrong. And my own advice, free of charge, to Mr. Zuckerberg and his company, which is now being besieged on every side, is you try to be proactive with respect to this stuff and ask yourself whether or not if you were a conservative, you would be comfortable with the kinds of regulations that you put on now that you're a liberal. Because remember, he's in a very bad position. It's not only the conservatives that are taking after them, but the liberals and the progressives are going after these people as well, both on the monopoly theories and on the refusal to remove sites. And so, you know, it may be that Facebook is an indispensable company for the United States today, but it's so big and that it's not just Jeremy Carl that's attacking it. It's pretty much everybody. And I'm sitting there basically mildly sympathetic to them because I think, in effect, that it's easy to haul off against people who are trying to do a decent job, and it's very hard to tell them what it is that they ought to do in ways that will command universal assent. So my usual reaction on this stuff is it's easy to find the problem, harder to find the cure.
As we close out, let me zoom out from the regulatory side for a moment and get to a cultural anxiety about Silicon Valley, but one that has policy implications. There's a lot of anxiety out there right now about the extent to which automation is going to displace workers, not just in the short term, but the idea here is that the number of actual low-skilled jobs out there may dramatically shrink. And you have some Silicon Valley titans out there who suspect this will be the case, and thus propose to solve it by means of what's called a universal basic income. This is essentially a conditionless cash payment that would bring everyone up to a certain basic standard of living. So really, therein, I guess, two questions. One, do you buy the predicate, the sort of this time is different argument about automation? And two, to what degree are you enthusiastic about the prospect of a universal basic income?
Well, enthusiastic would never be the word for universal basic income. Tolerable, maybe. But let's go back to the first point. The first time I heard about automation displacing everybody was back in 1955 or six, when it turns out the telephones were going to be automated. And sure enough, you know, all these operators are losing their jobs, and you can't watch Judy Holliday on television being one of these screen operators. Well, if you tried to run phone conversations today with human beings, there would be no phone calls because everybody would have to be an operator. That's what the volume has turned up to. And another illustration that, which occurred to me is I happened when I was on trip in the Danube. I went to the BMW plant. And this thing is heavily automated. You see these machines doing the most incredible kinds of things. They look like dances. Fred Astaire in Shall We Dance in front of these machines. And they're doing this and they're doing that. They also have hundreds of workers in that plant. So what I do is I ask the tour guide, if this place is so automated, why is it that you have all of these workers? And they say, well, there's certain things that machines turn out cannot do. And that the efficient solution in a factory is man-machine interfaces. And what a company like BMW does is to figure out where at the margin it's cheaper to use one than the other. So when they want to figure out how you get these little, you know, paint bubbles out of paint, they don't use any machines, they use human hands. When they're trying to figure out how it is you position the engine so it can be screwed into the chassis, the man puts it, you know, the men or the women put it into the thing, and then the machines tighten it. So it, what happens is the mistake in the analysis is to always assume that the two things are substitutes for one another, when in many times they're complements. So put it this way. If, in fact, you now expand the production of your automobile lines and lower the prices so you get greater sale, it turns out that instead of having a heavily human situation where you had 10,000 workers, now you got a lot of machine stuff going in there, and you still have 5,000 or 6,000 workers on the floor. And there are a bunch of other people taking jobs in other factories which pick up the slack because you're picking up and overturning the basic outcome. So it's just not at all clear that this is going to happen. If you look at the unemployment figures, the deregulation of the domestic economy has led to very low rates of unemployment, and a lot of this stuff is going down to the bottom of the market. The most interesting figures are the rate of African-American unemployment is down because the market is up. All of a sudden, there are people who are trying to find ways to hire criminals where that was never thought to be before. Retirees are being lured back into the market and so forth. And so I think that it's just crazy. It may well be that certain jobs are going to go overseas, but there are going to be other jobs created to bring people back. And there's certain jobs that just can't go overseas. The number of exercise gyms that you start seeing around the United States today is way up. The number of restaurants is way up and all this stuff. Now, they're going to be automated in part, but it's very, very clear that if you're trying to figure out what the American labor market looks like and concentrate on manufacturing, you're making two mistakes. One, you tend to forget that this is an extremely efficient sector in the United States, but the number of workers that it's employed for many years now is quite low, mainly because it's the kind of work which is better done by machines, and you get fewer lung injuries and fewer burn injuries. So workman's compensation today is not about actual injuries on the job. It's worried about horseplay and vengeful spouses coming into the workplace and shooting somebody up or getting stung by bees. I mean, the whole industry has completely transformed itself under these things. Now, the second part has to do with this guaranteed minimum wage, and this cannot be the right solution. If you're talking about a situation where you've got 3 or 4% of the economy or population which is out of whack, and then what you're trying to do is to figure out how it is you start giving guaranteed incomes to 100% of the economy, well, obviously, if you're going to pay everybody, there's going to be at least somebody who's going to have to pay into the system more than they take out. It's going to require an implicit progressive tax. Once that starts to be done, it's going to reduce capital formation and so forth, probably increase unemployment levels. There are earned income tax credits that we already have, which might be expanded or kept in their place. But my own view about this and I'm going to end on this note, is I wrote several columns and articles some years ago with the following title called Redistribution Last. And what that means is there's certainly a need to make sure that the least fortunate amongst ourselves can have some kind of minimum subsistence. But before you start thinking of government programs, you think of two other things. First, the deregulation approach, which gets people back into the market by removing the barriers to entry, which are created by such things as minimum wage laws, labor unions, family leave statutes, the whole part of the welfare state stuff, which is a giant barrier to entry. And secondly, once it turns out you get rid of that stuff and the incomes are better at the top end, you'd want to see what level private charities and assistance can do. And I think you could do fairly well. And only then do you start thinking about the government. But before you could even think about trying to give a minimum wage or guaranteed income to people, somebody better worry about, well, what are you going to do about the Social Security problem, the Medicare problem, the Medicaid problem, right? The pension problem in the United States. We are running huge public deficits. Putting another program on top of this is not going to work very easily. And the solution, at least to some of those problems that we previously mentioned, is a form of deregulation to get productivity up. And if the stock market moves up with it, then the pension funds start to do a little bit better and the deficits get a bit smaller and we get more wiggle room. Paul Krugman famously said, now that Donald Trump is president, we're going to have a huge recession. Now, I'm no fan of Donald Trump on many things, but I'm certainly no fan of Paul Krugman because I still believe that the old notion of deregulation and low taxes first is the right answer. And I think that's what we need to do here. The difficult problems of Silicon Valley cannot be solved by some kind of guaranteed minimum income.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.